Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Folta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show, Science Facts and Fallacies, episode 201. My name is Cameron English. I am your host, joined as always by the venerable, the handsome, Dr. Kevin Folta. Kevin, what's going on? How are you?
Venerable.
I got a thesaurus for Christmas, so.
Oh, very nice. Yeah. Everything is super cool. We're getting ready to roll into another crazy weekend of unseasonably freezing weather, so I won't get to sleep for 3 days while I protect citrus from certain death. Good times.
Sleep's overrated, man. You can do without it, you know.
I know. It's actually killing me. I have completely alienated Maslow's hierarchy of needs first level. I have none of the things that you need on the first level. Like, they're all gone. So it's been really rough. I've found Maslow's basement.
By the way, we needed a new gimmick. So I recently received this button as a gift. So I'm going to break this out on occasion, and it's fully interactive.
Fake news.
So what's it saying? I can't read it.
Can you hear it?
Fake news media. You are fake news.
You know, oh, yeah. Okay, good. Really nice.
Okay.
Yeah, we need more of a morning zoo feel to this thing.
Yeah, there's no fart noises yet. We haven't quite programmed that, but we do have the fake news button that I'm almost certainly going to overuse.
All right. Well,
good deal. Even today, because we're professionals.
That's right.
In any case, we do have three stories as usual to talk about. Very excited for all these. So first up, zero detectable cancer cells. Experimental CRISPR therapy apparently cures a young girl's uncurable leukemia. Next up, the tobacconization of corporations, how green activist groups delegitimized industry despite the value of their products. And finally, from our very own Kevin Folta, glyphosate and other toxic herbicides in your kids' school lunches. Food Chain Radio features disinformation specialist, our old friend Kevin Zen Honeycutt. It's going to be a great one. Looking forward to talking about glyphosate for the nth time. But some good news first, Kevin. Tell us about this CAR T therapy.
This is really cool. And I love these stories because, you know, there's so many people who are affected by cancers, and especially as things like heart attacks and strokes become less frequent because of improved health, you start to see the increased incidence of these long-term degenerative diseases and things like cancer starting to, you know, maybe become a little bit more prevalent. And there's a lot of argument that says that as we, you know, get better and better at surviving the mundane, these will become more formidable adversaries. But we've got biotechnology, and this is what is so cool. This is about Alyssa. She's a 13-year-old little girl from Leicester, England. And she had something called T-cell acute lymphoblastic leukemia. And this is a rare kind of leukemia. You commonly can get kids showing different types of leukemias. Typically between 2 and 5 is the highest time that they are about to present. And it happens relatively frequently, but they're very good cure rates. For some, that's not possible. And you can continue to get chemotherapy and radiation and the regular regimen of treatments, and they just don't work. And that's the same thing that Alyssa went through here. She went through a bone marrow transplant, chemotherapy, and there are no other options. So physicians went ahead with this idea of a modified T cell that now would be able to attempt to cure the problem. And, you know, I'll give you the spoiler alert: so far, so good. So how do they do this? And the basic idea is that you're able to take T cells, which are the cells that target cancers, not just by producing antibodies, but by physically attacking abnormal cells. And you can create what are called CAR T cells, which CAR T means they're a chimeric antigen receptor, CAR, C-A-R. And the CAR T cells, you engineer, you take someone's T cells, their natural killer cells, and now you give them a target to search for. So you engineer them genetically to produce essentially the key to the lock that's on the cell. So the cell presents a specific surface antigen with some cancers, and now you told the T cell, here's where you find it, go find it, you find it, locks on, kills it. And so she now has these re-engineered cells. They were donor cells that came to her. And the article wasn't real specific about the genetic changes that were made. But I can tell you from previous alterations that were done genetically how they did this. So one way that this appears to have been done was by identifying the actual T cells that were targeting the cancer cells, and then making a whole bunch more of them by creating the same genetic change in general cells, in general T cells. So that was them making a lot more of them. That was one way to do it. The other thing that's been done in cases of childhood leukemia has been to remove the surface antigens that do not recognize the cells as foreign. So in other words, you receive cells from someone else, T cells, they're going to appear to be foreign to the body. You're going to reject them. There's all kinds of issues with cytokine storm and all these other things that happen when you give someone an infusion of cells that aren't theirs. And this is particularly hazardous with children. So some of the successful leukemias that have been treated have been cases where they've used gene editing to specifically remove or alter the surface antigens so that they're no longer immunogenic. So now you have cells that can target cancer cells and not induce an immune response as foreign. And this seems to be what they did with Alyssa. And so far, everything looks very positive.
And it's been, what, 6 months since she had this therapy?
6 months and okay. Looking good so far. But she's not out of the woods yet, but right. Looking pretty good.
But I think they said something like it's the first year or the first 18 months. Like this is the pivotal part where it's most likely to come. The disease is most likely to rear its head again. So if she makes it through this, this is like a very good sign, right?
Right. It is a very good sign. And the other thing that's nice about the way they did this approach is that the cells that they're using as the therapeutic cells are not likely to be attacked by other methods that may be used to repress the cancer. So she can kind of do this conventional and new at the same time, maybe even see some synergistic effects. But the exciting part about this is that here we see this new wave of therapies that we talked about 5 years ago that are the rubber's hitting the road, and it's doing it for a 13-year-old girl, and that's super cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't imagine the tragedy that must be as a family to go through that. So to get back to the biology of it a little bit, they talk about using this relatively new technique called base editing. So for people who may not know what that is, can you explain how base editing differs from like a typical CRISPR-Cas9 based approach to this?
What they were talking about was base editing essentially as changing the existing amino acid structure of a given protein to change just that one base, to change just to create smaller mutations. And most of the time we're doing deletions with gene editing. This is a case where you're actually doing base editing to change what that base is. And so gene editing has always had the downside of it really creates deletions best, and that you don't have a good way to address a specific change necessarily, but the tools are getting better. And I don't know the fidelity in this. It's something very new, but apparently that's what they were able to do here to create T cell based receptors that could target specific cancers.
Okay. So this is, I think it's something like just 6 years old. So this is really new. And I know you said we're not really sure about the fidelity, but it seems like this gives the doctors or whoever's going to be treating her, it gives them the specificity to keep these cells from attacking one another, because that's a problem as well. because they're killer T cells. So they see each other and they go, hey, let's you and me fight. That can be a problem. And then you said there's these nasty side effects. So with this approach, you can minimize those to a certain extent, it seems. Is that true?
Yeah, that seems to be the case. What you're looking at is essentially just another way to create. But the big concern there was specificity in when you're doing gene edits. There are too many off-target effects, right? That's been the big criticism of gene editing. Compared to a terminal leukemia, probably not so much of a problem. But what they discuss in the article here is that there is increased specificity. There's no data to show that, so take them at their word. But as a breakthrough, this is what they're talking about as a new line of treating these kinds of specific cancers.
Yeah, it's really cool. I heard an oncologist many years ago giving a TED talk, and he said the problem with most of our therapies for the last, 50, 60 years is that it's basically shit against the wall pharmacology. You just find some toxic chemical or some brew and you throw it at the cancer and go, I hope that works and I hope it kills the cancer before it kills the patient. And it seems that we're very slowly getting away from that and we're getting more targeted therapy. So overall, it's very, very encouraging stuff. I don't know how many of these we've talked about now. It must be at least four or five different cases of these different therapies, Kevin. And so far, they all seem to be working. So I'm hopeful.
Yeah, I think more realistically, they either work or they don't. I know that sounds ridiculous, but it seems as though, and this is what's really interesting, is that there may be some heterogeneity in populations where these therapies just don't work. And so you see cases where people get a miraculous recovery from something like a glioblastoma, right? What is typically a very aggressive cancer. Other people, complete recovery. Other ones, no, doesn't do anything. If anything, makes them sicker. And so there's this weird kind of overlay in the heterogeneity of the population or the patients' classes that are studied that I don't know that they understand yet. And it's really intriguing because what it says is that there clearly are more genetic complexities that you have to account for. But this is the way we learn what they are. And I think we are in really the good old days, or I shouldn't say good old days. This is basically the Wright brothers of molecular personalized medicine. Let's put it that way.
Right.
And I think someday in the not too distant future, the jet age will come very fast.
Yeah.
So I have a student who I'm writing a letter of recommendation for whose father is in one of these T-cell therapy things, and he also has exhausted everything else. He's younger than me, and he's exhausted everything else, and she takes a lot of comfort in the fact that in class we talked about T-cells and talked about CAR T-cell therapy and how this is something her father is now receiving. So talking about these things gives us a lot of hope. I get a little misty thinking about it because, she's one of my students. It's one of these it says that there's a lot of hope that can come from the fact that when you get a terminal diagnosis, now there's a few more cards in the deck.
Yeah.
And I think that means a lot to people who are going through this and families that are going through it. So stay healthy as long as you can, because the cavalry is on the way.
Yeah. Yeah. We sometimes forget that these are real people in these trials that we're talking about. You start looking at statistics and you maybe you get distracted from what's important, but these are 13-year-old girls or fathers and brothers and sisters. It's great stuff. So we'll definitely revisit this, but let's move on. Our old friend Dr. David Zarek is back with an excellent story, a really solid analysis here of I guess what he is called the tobacconization of industry. So what's he talking about there, Kevin?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting article because I like this one because when someone wants to when I mention something that's science, we talk about something in a controversial area, whether a vaccine works or a genetically engineered crop is safe or glyphosate might not be killing you, or the first thing people try to do is discredit you by saying, well, obviously you're paid by the corporation. Obviously you're a shill, right? So really the tobacco card is really just a way to call a corporation a shill of itself. I guess, right? So it's just a way of doing that. So basically what, and this is really something I never really thought about before. It's just a way of indicting a corporation by saying, well, they're just big tobacco. And I think that this is being used more and more, and what David has shown, or Dr. Zurek has shown, is that there are patterns inside this indictment of being a big tobacco, being another big tobacco, right? There's a certain pattern that you see. And what it basically comes from is this idea that in the EU and other places, they're making decisions based on this precautionary principle, precaution above all else. And as I've always said, precaution is based upon your level of privilege. Some people don't have the privilege to be precautious. So you really have to be careful when talking about the precautionary principle. You don't want to be so conservative in implementing new technology that you actually hurt people. And I believe that we do that. And I believe the EU does very much. So the part of this that Zurek talks about is really the different steps that you see. And we've seen this repeated over and over again with different companies, whether it's Exxon or Monsanto or whatever. And the question really comes down to, maybe they deserve it as a company, maybe not. You know, Volkswagen, you know, there's a whole bunch of examples he gives. But at the end of the day, what he is really talking about isn't attacking a company based upon the strengths and limitations of the argument, but rather an across-the-board de facto elimination because you're the big shill, right? You're the big tobacco. And so how do you create this perception of big tobaccoism? And the first part he talks about is this idea of adversarial regulation. Can you create the perception in the public mind by using social media, by using all these other tools that, hey, this company's a bad actor? And it doesn't matter whether it's true or not. You can spread enough false information to get regulators and legislators to act to create legislation or regulations that make it harder for these folks to operate, these big companies to operate. And that's really kind of the step one. If you can do it and you do it right, you can essentially drive them out of business by regulating them to death. And that's really his first point. I'm going to stop for a second and push my mute button and cough if you want to talk about this first point.
Yeah, one thing I want to get your input on when you're done getting the frog out of your throat is that a lot of industries are, to a certain extent, they're complicit in this because the approach they've taken is more or less, we're going to keep our heads down. We're going to get, you know, a really fancy public relations firm, and they're going to help us be nice and public, and we're going to do a fundraising drive, and that's going to help people, you know, that's going to improve our reputation with the public. And all the while, you have the activist groups who are literally passing laws that say these companies are not allowed to interact with policymakers unless they're going through some sort of a trade group. And meanwhile, these activist groups directly lobby the government, and they attack these corporations in public. They file the lawsuits like you were just talking about, and they basically turn the tables and they make it so you cannot even participate in the discussion about the product that you manufacture or the service that you provide. And this has totally poisoned the discussion. And that's the first thing I wanted to talk about. I'm just so fascinated by a lot of these companies, and he calls them zebras. He says, you know, you're the second to the slowest zebra, so you don't get eaten today, and that's good enough for you. So I find that whole dynamic really, really striking, Kevin. So talk about that if you would.
Well, no, I agree 100% that these are essentially toothless companies that aren't fighting back or can't afford to fight back. And it's cheaper to roll over and say, just settle out of court than to fight it. And then this is the irony of this, is that I'm not necessarily a big fan of corporations. I mean, I work in a university. I'm in the public sector. I like being a public sector scientist. I hate my bank and I'm scumbags who made my car and all, you know, I'm not a big fan of corporate, whatever, you know, I mean, it's just the way it is. But I do see the irony here in that the folks who really are pulling the strings and the folks who are well-financed by big business are the activists that are going after other big businesses that just don't share their ideology. So it's easy to vilify a, you know, Monsanto or Bayer or Volkswagen or whatever if you're their competition. And I think you're seeing a lot of that. I think especially in the food industry where there's so many groups who are trying to paint anything that's not, you know, Red Barn, Red Tractor, organic as something dangerous. And they got lots of money. And they throw a lot of money to create fear and uncertainty and doubt around other companies that use maybe genetics or other types of inputs they don't approve of. And they can say that that's big tobacco, you know, that's just the tobacco industry tactics, which, you know, we never really defined what those were. But the idea of creating false information to promote your business agenda, which is really what these groups are doing. So the folks who are demonizing big ag, you know, I'm trying to get the air quotes in the right place here. Big ag.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. They're not, they're the ones with the deep pockets, and they're the ones with the dollars, and they're the ones who are not always telling the truth. And so that's just like the shill gambit. That's what this all comes back to. Who's really telling the truth about the products and their safety? And so, so I hope I answered your question with that one.
Yeah. I just wish that, because I'm sitting here, you know, in my home office, and I look out on the world and I go, you just have to push back against this. This is outrageous, you know? And I've talked about being a new dad. I go to the grocery store and I buy my son these little like prepackaged snacks from Gerber and these other companies. Every single one of them has an organic USD organic certification or a non-GMO project butterfly on it. And it drives me nuts. It's the whole kids section. So I know that everything that I could buy there is inflated in price because all of these companies have capitulated to these activist groups who have been harassing them for years about using GMOs, you know. So I bring up that example to say there's real consequences here. You know, these are very sharp public relations experts who are strong-arming these companies that make useful products that we all use. It could be anything from your cell phone to a watch to baby food. And they don't want the fight, so they capitulate or they sue or they settle out of court, like you were saying. And Zarek talks about this in the article that, you know, eventually this could be very serious. And you're starting to see it now in Europe with fuel shortages. I've heard in Germany that it's exorbitantly expensive to buy firewood, you know, during the winter. It's been that bad. So he asked the rhetorical question. He says, like, how bad does it have to get before the public realizes that they're being bamboozled by people who don't have their best interest at heart? He says someone has to stand up and push back against this.
No, that's exactly right. It's the baby food thing is interesting. I know, you know, we got ours on the way. We've got Jontra on the way. My wife will be breastfeeding, so I have to get her the butterfly tattoo, the non-GMO project. It's just so the baby knows.
That right. No glyphosate.
No, that's interesting. Now we're going to call her Jontra because if she calls for a restaurant and for a reservation, she makes Jontra Folta.
Yeah.
To get good table. Yeah, no, that's, I wish I made that up. That's a really good one. And all of this stuff is true because what you eventually see, and the other thing he brings up is this idea of getting corporations or getting rules, policy to limit advertising and communication. And so when you take Joe Camel off the market and all that, and I understand, you know, they shouldn't be appealing to kids or running cigarette commercials on prime time, all that stuff. But it starts to go to products that are not hazardous. So when you paint corn as dangerous as tobacco, right, now all of a sudden policymakers, by tobacconizing safe products, now all of a sudden you're disallowing their advertisement, you're disallowing other types of communications that can reach the public. And so it's another leg, another arm of this octopus that that Zarek points out and is right on. And yet the people who are really making up the false information are free to advertise, but free to advertise in really egregious ways, like sticking labels on baby food or, commercials that misrepresent the science. And that's really another big part of this tobacconization issue.
Yeah. And I should add, by the way, and I implied this earlier and I shouldn't have done it, David didn't make up this term. This is actually a term and a strategy that was devised by the Union for Concerned Scientists, which is a very prominent activist group. They've sort of backed off the GMO issue in recent years, but they're still very critical of factory farming and pesticides and these sorts of things. And in 2012, there was a conference out here in California, and it was this group, and it was this individual named Naomi Oreskes, who's a very prominent, I believe she's a historian of science, but she wrote a book called Merchants of Doubt. And so their whole approach is to say, everybody who's our political opponents, they're the merchants of doubt and they're the science deniers. And then they run this playbook over and over and over. And of course, they've done it most prominently that we've discussed to Monsanto and these other crop protection companies. But the same trial lawyers that are involved in that work are now trying to do it against cell phones, right? So I'm curious to see if this really does go forward. Are people going to push back against that? Because, you know, if you're like me, you've got a Samsung or an iPhone or whatever. Everything in your life is tied to that device. And so what happens when your phone goes up? They're already expensive. What happens when the price goes up 20 or 30% because these companies, you know, are fighting these absurd class action lawsuits based on the lie that your phone's going to give you brain cancer? And we know there's no evidence for that.
Yeah, but you can buy a new phone with your settlement. that's the funny part about this. It's a really nice example. And when they're talking about 5G and 5G being, you know, causing, how when you're AT&T or Verizon, how do you possibly address litigation against a class of 100,000 people who are making a claim that they've got some sort of health issue because of 5G? I mean, we've seen it with glyphosate. We've seen it with, you know, silicone breast implants years ago. We saw it with
baby powder.
You know, there's example after example, and it's only going to keep going until the tort system reforms. Mm-hmm. And not tort like the kind of cake, which I think about every time I think of tort reform, is how about a little more icing? Until the system changes and we don't make it as lucrative for attorneys to cash in, the attorneys make all the money. You know, the law firms get their 40%, and 40% of several billion is pretty hefty. And then everybody who's a plaintiff in the class, you know, they get their check for $14.73. And, you know, and so it's really a horrible system that's set up in a way that doesn't allow companies to fight back fairly. And then they don't. And I wish they would. I wish that in glyphosate, Bayer would have never settled. But yeah, it would have driven the company to bankruptcy in court, you know, dealing with individual case after individual case, mm-hmm. where if you lose 5% of them, you're out of money. You know, you got, and so it's a really, really sad situation. When really what we should be doing is following the science.
Yeah. Yeah, we could talk about this all day. I just one final thing is I find fascinating that, and what probably scares a lot of these companies away is that the media gets involved and the very idea of putting up a defense becomes a scandal, you know? So I saw this with the baby powder, you know, when those lawsuits were ongoing before Johnson & Johnson pulled the stuff off the market, you literally can't buy talc-based baby powder in the U.S. anymore. But before that happened, Reuters ran this really detailed series, and the whole scandal was that the company internally, you know, the company scientists were talking to each other and they're saying, okay, well, how do we respond to this argument? And here's the data we have. How do we present this? And that itself became the narrative that the media pushed, was that people say this product causes cancer and the company says it doesn't. How, you know, it's like, well, yeah, of course they're going to do that. They're not, you know, I mean, the whole thing's a mess. So I don't know if there's an answer, Kevin, but you have to fight back. That's one thing I can say is it works. I know you've seen this in your career too, but some of these people, like our old friend Kerry Gillum, will show up in the comment sections of my articles because I steamroll her with evidence, and her followers start to see it, and it gets traction on Twitter, you know, and she's, you know, so she has to show up and call me a Monsanto show. I have no relationship with Monsanto. The company doesn't even exist, but in any case, you know, this is the silliness that we're dealing with, Kevin. So, I don't know. Well, anyways, while we're on the topic of glyphosate, why don't we talk about, the lovely Zen Honeycutt, who you're good friends with.
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, we stepped off on the wrong foot a long time ago. It was probably about 13 years ago that maybe 12, whatever it was. It was a while ago that they published this thing called the Stunning Corn Comparison. That one of my friends, who's a chiropractor, he sends in, you know, he's very, likes to debate these things. He sends me a thing and says, ha ha, what about this? And I said, the Stunning Corn Comparison. And said, here's what they call GMO corn and regular corn, and how the regular corn had zero carbon in it and 98% glyphosate. And glyphosate, of course, is made up of carbon. So how they did that, we don't know. But, I mean, these numbers were doctored numbers in a table that were so false they could not have been biological. And I pointed that out on her website, and she got really mad and banned me from the website. And I just asked very nice questions about it. Well, this can't be real. This is more glyphosate in the corn than you apply in the field, than you apply when you apply it. How is it making more? You know, well, it does that. That's Monsanto wants you to believe. Anyway, so it was a long story. So anyway, she's still around and still wreaking havoc in causing fear, uncertainty, and doubt around agricultural products and genetic engineering. They've really backed off on genetic engineering and focused on the herbicide. So that's where they're going as a proxy of this. And you know, to her, I don't want to say credit, but being sensitive to her situation, her and some other mothers have kids who have some sort of problems. And whatever they are, I don't know, Crohn's or autism or whatever, where they absolutely 100% have blamed this on agricultural chemistry and genetic engineering. And so they're huge proponents for organic food and all this kind of stuff. So anyway, they had Zen on Michael Olson's show called Food Chain Radio. And I've never listened to this before, never knew of it, but man, it was weak. He has a pretty substantial following. It's a syndicated radio show on AM, so lots of old people probably listen. but they had Zen Honeycutt, and I couldn't believe what I was hearing. It was basically him just letting her go off on whatever rant she wanted, and she was absolutely saying 100% that glyphosate causes autism and causes cancer. No maybes, no whatever, no doubt in her mind. And she went on to talk about school lunches. And apparently the thing they've done in the past is they take some sort of product like a school lunch or whatever, wine or whatever, and they use this Abraxas competitive ELISA kit, which is a kit made for water or urine. It's made for water, but it works with urine, and gives you a quantitation, an effective quantitation of glyphosate, a very quick and dirty assay. It's pretty good and seems to work very well, has a good limit of detection, all that stuff. But you can't just use it on anything. And they've used it on breast milk, and they've used it on wine, I think, and just all the kinds of stuff. And they make these big claims that there's something there where there can't be, where there isn't, because you can't use the assay for that. You're getting a false positive. So they've made a lot of bad claims over the years. Well, now lunches, school lunches, and they had things tested that were in school lunches. And I think they had these tested properly by a legitimate organization. So I'll give them kudos for that. But they were finding these parts per billion, which means seconds in 32 years, of glyphosate detected. And to her, any number that's not zero is a warning flag. So she was on the show talking about the hazards in our school lunches of exposure of children to these chemicals and then their chemical connection to autism and cancer. And I sat typing the whole time, going through just typing, you know, answering every claim as it was made. And I posted it on the website, and I think this was November 5th or something. It's still awaiting moderation. My guess is that the moderator, if you just ignore it enough, it goes away. But I was able to effectively refute every claim she made, and it was probably on the order of 20 different claims. So very sad that this would happen. The big ramification being, of course, that in a lot of places, school lunch is the best thing that the kids get, which is totally gross that would happen. But in a lot of homes, homes either with working parents or no money or both, this is something important. And kids need to get it. And now to scare parents away from it or scare kids away from it, it's one of the unfortunate residues of the tobacconization of school lunches. So this was a really sad article. And was it written by me and Genetic Literacy Project?
Yeah, well, you mentioned tobacconization, but to go back to our last story, you tried to post this, I think it was on his Facebook page or his website. And they would not let you, you know, and of course you have the right to moderate your own platforms or whatever, but it's fascinating that they don't want to even interact with you. And you'll find this with all of them. You know, I mentioned Carrie Gillum earlier, or any of these people, when you criticize them, they won't engage your arguments. They will call you a shill or they'll call you a mean name, or they'll say you're dishonest, you can't be trusted, but that's all they'll say. Right. So they are trying to control the conversation, but here we can talk about the science. So you put a list together. It was like, I want to say like 30 or 35 different things she said that were wrong. So why don't you go through some of these? Several of them are uncommon in that we don't talk about them as often. So maybe you can start with one of those.
Yeah, well, I think there are 23 of them altogether now that I look at it. But you know, a lot of the things she was talking about was quoting Don Huber, who is the guy who made up the story about there being an organism in genetic engineered crops that feeds on glyphosate and causes, you know, sickness in people and gives plants AIDS.
And he was originally an ag scientist for some company, wasn't
sure.
he?
No, yeah. He worked for Purdue. And okay. He's a very recognized plant pathologist, and just about everybody, you can't go to a university and swing a dead cat by the tail and not hit somebody who had him for a class. And he was a, you know, reasonable, but somewhere I think the word was that he got crossed by Monsanto and some sort of patent thing as a professional, and therefore dedicated his life to throwing down a company and started just making up crazy stuff. And he was there's a lot of famous things. My interactions with him have been very interesting over the years. But going back to the article, she cites the stuff about from Seneff and Swanson, where they show the correlations between glyphosate and autism, and then she says that glyphosate is this great antibiotic and a chelator and all these things where really it's not so good. Otherwise, it would be used for that. other things that she talks about were, you know, how it's not regulated, how there are pesticides in food that are causing problems. And she uses words like, you know, they're drenched in herbicides or infused with herbicides. It, all of it is really scary stuff that just makes people wonder. And it's so sad because you're talking about, you know, as healthy as school lunches get. And this does have blowback in places like Minnesota. In some affluent areas, there's parents who are making demands to change the school lunches to, you know, all organic alternatives. And it's tremendously expensive for schools to do that. The organic milk is twice the price. And it also creates this weird classism among kids because they have to have parents pay for the higher price for those alternatives. And kids won't touch the institutionalized pizza, but they'll eat the organic sunflower seeds. So it creates a lot of problems. And to have suspicion around good health, around healthy alternatives. There's nothing dangerous about school lunches. Maybe they're not the most healthy thing in the world, but nothing dangerous.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just ridiculous. I saw something in there about glyphosate's going to make DDT look like mouthwash and all of these absurd things. You know, I can't, I can't even fathom how people believe this stuff, Kevin. Not the public. I could understand why, not understanding these topics, you could believe someone saying that. But someone like Zen Honeycutt, or especially Don Huber with a background in plant pathology, the fact that you could say some of this stuff knowing that it's false, unless you have a screw loose and maybe you believe it then. But I, to say something as mild as glyphosate is more toxic than DDT, which itself is not particularly toxic when it's used appropriately. You know, the whole thing's just a travesty. I don't know what else to say.
Yeah, but I think this is the big take-home message, is that here is what bothers me, is that she's willing to throw a generation of children under the bus,
right,
and distort and have fear and uncertainty about their food to advance her own agenda. And that really rubs me wrong. And that's why we had to talk about it here. It's really important. Can I throw in one other fun thing today?
Absolutely.
Oh, do you have anything else on that last story?
I don't think so. This, whatever you're about to say is going to be more entertaining. So
no, it's actually kind of funny. I realized today, you know, Peter McCullough, the cardiologist turned anti-vax doctor. I found out today that I was preemptively blocked by him. I've never had any interaction with him. I've never posted on his Twitter feed. I've nothing. And I'm preemptively blocked. And the funny part is the name of his website, Courageous Discourse. So creating a courageous discourse by preemptively blocking those that may challenge us.
Yeah, he's one of those guys. I saw him on Joe Rogan. He seems like a sharp dude, that he's got a real publication record and he's got some accomplishments to his name. But he just, something about him, like, he just seems off a little bit, you know? So yeah. It doesn't surprise me that someone in his network probably said, this Folta guy, this is bad news bears. You got to block this dude before.
Well, he publishes with Stephanie Seneff.
Does he really?
Yeah. They published an article about, I forgot which one it was now, but I think they did the one where the COVID vaccine spike protein activates prions. I think that was the one. So if you're getting mad cow disease, you know, anyway, it's nice to be on the radar, to be preemptively blocked by someone you've never interacted with.
Yeah, dude.
I mean, yeah, it says that maybe you're bringing a little something to the table that they don't want on the table. So that's cool. I'll take it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one thing if you pester someone on Twitter and they block you and then you celebrate that like it's some achievement. But if you don't even say anything and they go seek you out to block you, man, that's incredible. All right. Well, we'll call it a day there. Another podcast in the can. We're done with the Twitter follows. I think I ran out of people to recommend, just because I recommended everyone that I read and that I learned from. And now I'm like, okay, follow AC/DC.
When it's like, when I knew that when I was saying follow Steakums, that it was kind of done. Yeah, we kind of run the gamut here. Even though Steakums did have rather insightful tweets, I think it was a great idea that kind of went the course. So if anybody listening has a cool idea for segment on recommendations or ideas, or maybe a cooking segment with Cameron.
Yes. I've got my fake news button. This'll hold us over.
Come on, it's fake news.
That'll hold us over. But maybe like an audience question, you know, you guys can submit questions, or we could do, I don't know, an ask me anything that Kevin and I can do if you're into that. Something. We'll think of something. But
that's a good one, especially if we could do it live.
Yeah.
Because I don't want people to think we're preparing. I like when shooting from the hip.
Very clearly, Kevin likes to shoot from the hip, judging by all the dad jokes. John Travolta, for example. It's a great one. That's a great one. It's even better than the Queens. By the way, my wife hates that name, and I love it even more as a result. So sometimes I call our son to Queens. She goes, I really wish you'd stop doing that. I'm not gonna. I love it. All right. That's it. Follow us on Twitter. We're still there at Kevin Folta, at ACSH.org for my writing. My website is CameronJEnglish.net. Thank you as always. See you next time.